I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. So what if the way we judge companies is all wrong? Forget the Fortune 500, which only ranks how big you are. How about how creative and innovative you are? We already know who's successful, but where is the next big idea going to come from? That's what Hal Gregersen set out to discover, and along the way, he's done some serious thinking about the innovativeness and competitiveness, not just of companies, but also of countries and their people. Hal Gregersen is a professor at INSEAD and co-author of The Innovator's DNA and an author of Forbes' Most Innovative Companies. Hal Gregersen, thanks for being here.
Delighted to be here, Kara.
So let's start with somebody who you rank very highly on this list of innovative people and innovative companies, and that's Jeff Bezos, who is the CEO of Amazon. And I'm just going to play a little clip of him talking to Charlie Rose quite recently about, you know, how he sees Amazon being different.
We are willing to take a long-term point of view. We don't need things to pay back in just 1 or 2 or 3 years.
We're not obsessed by quarterly earnings.
No, and we're also, you know, willing to invent. And invention does take a certain amount of willingness. You have to be willing to be misunderstood. You have to be willing to fail. But invention is really important. And that's kind of, if I were to say, what are the three big ideas about Amazon? Those would be the three.
Long-term thinking, customer obsession, and willingness to invent.
Exactly. And those things will still be true, I hope, 10 years from now.
Hal Gregersen, how did Jeff Bezos create an organization that, in your view, is so different from most other companies?
Jeff Bezos was like 100-plus other innovators who created these organizations that disrupted entire industries. So if we look at Jeff specifically, he is an experimenter. From being a young child to an adult and now as an older adult, he always has approached the world with this very experimental attitude. And so he does that not only himself, but he does it with the people around him. Jeff told us that when he was interviewing recently for a CFO, a CFO coming into Amazon, he asked him, tell me about something you've invented. Now, I can't imagine that question being asked from most CEOs, but he wanted to know, not if you had a Nobel Prize invention, but if you confront a problem, do you have the capacity to invent a solution that will work? That's all he's looking for.
And, you know, you said that also in your book that he is always asking employees, look at the Amazon website, see what's going wrong. You sort of not to just be yes people, but really to think about things in maybe completely different ways than they're currently being thought about at the company.
Absolutely. So Jeff told us basically that my job as the CEO and founder of this company is to create an environment where not hundreds but thousands of experiments flourish. And by doing so, then we've got all these people trying new things. So the whole notion of Amazon being able to link different kinds of books to our most recent purchase or videos or whatever, that came from an experiment by an employee just trying something out. And then it became a very, very valuable tool for them. But that's the notion for Bezos is how can we reduce the cost of experimentation so thousands of these things are always going on?
And the interesting thing is, too, that he developed the company, the idea for the company, while he was looking at another company. And it was 1994, and he's looking on the internet, which is fledgling at that time, and he sees that it's growing at 2,300% a year. And he thinks, whoa, what? It's growing at 2,300% a year. So how did he get from working for somebody else to thinking, well, you know, this is a really new space. I'm going to make a stand in it.
Innovators have powerful peripheral vision. Even though they're experts and great at whatever they're doing, they see things in the corners of their eyes and their ears that other people don't sometimes notice. So Jeff noticed that incredible increase in the internet, its growth of 2,500 sort of percent. And he's thinking to himself, that's interesting, first of all, he noticed. Second then, what kinds of things might be sold on the internet? So he looked at the list of the top 25 things sold by catalog. And would these work? Maybe not. Maybe they would. Then he realized, well, books aren't sold on the internet, and they're not sold by catalog. And the reason why is the catalog would be too big. And so we could do that perfectly on the internet. And so it's a series of explorations, observations, and constructing those things together that enabled Jeff to figure out, a completely new way of selling books vis-a-vis the internet that started out by a simple peripheral vision observation of something interesting going on.
And books are in a way, a very good, just like music, are very good to sell online because they're content-based. You don't have to try them on. You know, you don't have to touch them. It's not that kind of thing.
They are, but one of the other founders we interviewed were Rent the Runway founders, which rents these high-end fashion, high-end designer clothing to women generally, trying to have something really nice. They can't afford it, but they rent it for a very low price to go to a party. Well, that came from an experimentation where the founders thought of maybe we could rent high-end clothing online for these special occasions, but they did a series of simple experiments. First, they went to one university, let them try the clothes on, and saw if they rented them. They did rent them. They brought them back in good condition. Then they go to a next university, low-cost experiment. You can touch them, but you can't try them on. And they rented them, but fewer. Then they go to a third low-cost experiment, different university, where it's just pictures of those dresses. And they still had a rental rate of around 5%, which is more than enough to make money on the internet. So it's a series of fairly low-tech experiments to get an idea that's now incredibly successful as an organization called Rent the Runway. Mm-hmm. But that's something that typically you would think we have to try on, but they built a business around an idea that still worked online.
You know, one of the interesting things to me in terms of what makes a successful and innovative company is how in touch, in your view, does the person who is running the company have to be with the sort of regular people who are down on the floor of the company? And I think of, since we're talking about Jeff Bezos, this incident you talk about where somebody at Amazon got their thumb messed up by leaving something on a conveyor belt, one of their warehouses, and Jeff Bezos sort of got personally involved. And I wonder, what does that tell you about him?
Innovative companies are led by innovative people. And what we mean by that is these are folks who are constantly asking provocative questions. They're observing the world like anthropologists. They talk to people to get new ideas who don't look, think, or act like them. They're willing to take the risk and experiment all the time. And that enables them to think differently and put together things and connections in ways that nobody else can. And so when you've got a CEO like Jeff Bezos at the top of Amazon who does that 4 months out of the year versus the CEO at a non-innovative company who spends about 2 months of their time innovating, that double factor, 4 versus 2 months, accumulate that over time, an innovative leader who does that so much of their life is simply more capable of generating ideas that do disrupt industries. And Bezos is a great example of that, from selling books online to his recent, you know, selling cloud computing online to who knows what's next. But he will experiment until it works because he himself is an experimenter.
And he goes down on the factory floor and tell the story of the guy whose thumb gets messed up. I don't know if from your...
Well, I mean, basically, you've got somebody whose thumb gets messed up, and the essence of it is they ask five whys, why, to figure out why on earth is that happening, and they uncover the reason for that being a problem, this person's thumb being hurt, and then they solve the problem. And it's not a unique thing to Amazon. Scott Cook at Intuit is great, and they sell Quicken and QuickBooks. They do the same thing. They constantly teach their people and train them and reinforce and reward folks to ask better questions, use the five whys. It's a slightly different example, but what they did at Intuit is they were giving people time to innovate, but people weren't taking the time. And so to do it. And so they realized through a series of why, the fundamental reason behind them not spending time innovating throughout the company, they simply didn't schedule the time in their calendar. Who would have guessed? And so that simple act of then forcing scheduling time into people's calendars around innovation and doing these skills and using them to get new ideas led to a multiple-fold increase in people actually doing it. And so the essence of it is it could be Amazon, it could be Intuit, it could be a number of other companies who are very innovative, but you have senior leaders who are reinforcing this all throughout the organization.
Now, I know when you changed to looking at innovation from looking at just what companies had been successful in the past, there were some losers too. Toyota, Honda, Samsung, Sony. Why did those companies end up losing ground in your list on Forbes versus just the biggest companies out there?
No doubt, you know, Honda, Toyota, Sony, in their own way, they do innovate. They get new ideas, they do new things. But what they don't do is they haven't put together new ideas that are fundamentally disruptive and change the terrain. And so ever since Akito Morita, the founder of Sony, left in the 80s, there's not been a senior leader at Sony who has acted like the Jeff Bezos of the world. In other words, these companies that are low on the list, they're there in part because the leaders of those organizations, they simply don't value innovative actions enough to do it themselves.
Hmm. Let's talk about one more innovative company that I know you've looked at and that may surprise people in terms of even thinking of it as a company. I'm going to play the president of Cirque du Soleil talking about how his company stays innovative.
The danger will be to be complacent about it and thinking that we have a recipe and that we will always continue to serve to the public a recipe. And as you know, the expectations of people now are getting higher and higher, and therefore it's important for us that we continue to innovate all the time, that we continue to take risk all the time, and that's what we do in order to avoid, you know, being chose du passé. And therefore, we invest a lot of money in research and development, a lot of money in casting. We travel around the world all the time. We have a group that is called the Trend Group. That function is to feed our creators about new artistic trends that there is about everywhere in the world. And that's the only way for us.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio, and we're talking with Hal Gregersen, professor at INSEAD and an author of Forbes' Most Innovative Companies. And Hal Gregersen, people think, I think, of Cirque du Soleil as a performance troupe, not as a company, but in fact, it's this incredibly interesting company. How does it stay ahead? How does it stay on top?
Like other companies who are innovative, Guy Laliberté, the founder of Cirque du Soleil, he's still there. He's been there from the beginning. And he himself is actively, constantly roving the world, trying to get new ideas for Cirque du Soleil. And it was Daniel Lamar who we heard just on the radio.
Right.
And basically, Danielle is always getting emails and texts and messages from Guy Laliberté all over the world about, I saw this, I did that. How could we incorporate this into the next show? And Guy Laliberté will not do a new show in a new place if it's a repeat. He only wants to do things that are new and different. So he does this himself. So you've got that at the top going on. And then you've got an organization. When I was there recently at their headquarters in Montreal, you know you're in a different place when you arrive at the corporate headquarters and you've got a 50-foot clown shoe in the front parking lot. Literally. I mean,
wow.
It's amazing. Then you walk through the front doors and you've got this 8-foot, 18th century curio box with all kinds of interesting things inside. And then you go meet with the CEO in this very unusual sort of room. And I asked him, for example, tell me about how you innovate at Cirque du Soleil. And he said, go to the cafeteria. That's an odd sort of thing. But you walk into that cafeteria, you can feel the electricity of the conversations going on because you've got people bumping into their spaces of different shows, different functions, different areas, and they're generating new ideas. And this is a place where we see that endpoint, which is the creative, compelling show. But to pull that off with these new ideas takes an incredible backstage set of people who are exceptional at delivery and execution, because when they're flying through that air, they've got to trust that everything's going to work flawlessly for them.
And they will do anything to keep innovation in the company, including hiring a clown.
It was so funny. The CEO, Daniel Lamar, he was talking with me and basically said, the other day Guy Laliberté came into his office and said, I've hired a new employee for you. And Daniel's like, well, who and why? And Guy was, I've hired a clown. Well, why a clown? Because it feels like we're getting too serious around this company and too somber in our approaches to things. And Madame Zuzu's job, from the corporate board down, if she's walking through any place in this organization and feels that heaviness, that people are just being too serious about their work and not vibrant enough with new ideas, her job is to change the place. And so literally, there could be a board meeting and she walks into that. If she senses they're getting, you know, just too serious about it all, she will do things to upset their apple cart.
Okay, so let's talk about how you cultivate that kind of creativity. And I know that you've been a little concerned about the ability of the American educational system to have that kind of creativity be part of it. So talk about what you think really works. Jeff Bezos grew up in a very creative situation, for example. And then we'll talk a little bit about how do you implement it?
What works and what we noticed in a lot of these innovators growing up is they had educational experiences or family experiences or both, where their intrinsic internal drive to explore the world never shut down, number one. And the second part is they were reinforced, supported, and rewarded for having that interest and then doing something about it. It was Jeff Bezos' grandfather who reinforced to him when they were trying to fix a broken-down tractor on a farm in Texas, if you just try 100 different ways, this tractor will finally work. For a lot of these innovators, it was a Montessori education experience where they went to school, they were exposed to things that they could choose, okay, I'm interested in that today. And then they would have this structured learning environment that allows them to observe, to experiment, to try things, to ask questions, and those things are highly valued.
So more project-based learning is...
Absolutely, because even in the biggest of companies, you know, recently Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, said, we get big things done through small teams, and that's the consistent theme we saw in all of these innovative companies. And part of those teams in a Montessori-like education is a multi-generational team. You've got three or four age levels in that same team, people teaching people. And it doesn't have to be an expensive Montessori education to make this happen.
Okay, so so I know you've taught all over the world, in France, in Abu Dhabi, in Singapore. When you go to other places, let's take Abu Dhabi, for example, because people don't talk about it as much, I think, and think about it as much as they do, for example, like China. What do you see in terms of people really being focused on education or being focused on success? What are you seeing?
I see a common theme, be it Abu Dhabi or France where we lived before that or London before that or traveling to China. Here's the common theme. You have children growing up in educational systems who aren't being prepared for the world they're going to grow into as adults. And so I take some of the Middle Eastern countries as an example, not to sort of poke fun at them or make fun of it, but this is where I've lived and been. You've got several generations that have been fairly wealthy now. You've got a younger generation that's growing up with that wealth, and as a result, some of them, many of them, aren't acquiring those skills of experimenting, observing, networking, asking the tough questions to get new ideas. And if they're not getting those skills as they're growing up, and if they're not acquiring them and being rewarded for them, in 5, 10, 15 years, I don't care what country it is, United Arab Emirates, China, or the United States, if we don't value those things, we will die. Economically, and perhaps even beyond that, you could argue spiritually, morally, whatever word you want to use, these are the things that keep us alive.
But you have seen, I know, incredible competition in other places like India, for example. Just incredible numbers of people who are very well qualified to get into top schools, which are really hard to get into. Do you look at a place like India and think, wow, we have no concept in the U.S. of how hard people are willing to work other places?
One of the security guards at our office in Abu Dhabi was from India, and he worked long, hard hours, and a high proportion of his money was sent back to India to put two of his children through university. He was making enormous sacrifices so those kids would have a future. I know that happens all over the world, but it's mind-boggling to imagine billion-plus people doing that for their children for that kind of future. Now, what those children are getting in India or China for the most part is an education that prepares them to act like what we've done in the U.S., for example, for decades. And because of that, if we keep doing things the same we have here in the United States and North America and this region, we will have, you know, people who are equally capable in China and India, and that's where the volume of those folks is just enormous. And what we have to do is figure out, wherever we are in the world, how can we nurture that next generation so that they acquire and keep these skills that will lead to this next disruptive idea that will solve the problems in the world that will be bigger than the ones we're facing 10 or 15 years
ago. And a place, you know, even an American company like a General Electric or General Motors, they can and do have huge campuses in India. So if people in the U.S. are only just keeping up, right, with their competitors in India, you're saying that's not enough.
It's not enough because, again, deep disruption, ideas that change the terrain and the surface of the world we live in don't happen overnight. We forget sometimes that Steve Jobs, in his 56 years of living, spent at least 18 years of his waking time actively getting new ideas. And that kind of commitment enabled him to see the crevices between industries and put together products that nobody else running an electronics company could figure out. That's the kind of commitment that we need to instill in these younger children so that they will do what they need to do to create equally great ideas.
So have you thought about how would you have to change the U.S. educational system to so that the U.S. was in 10 or 20 years in a really competitive place in the world?
I think on the educational system side, Tony Wagner's written a great book recently about creating innovators. And, you know, he does some great thinking around that. But essentially, it's opening up opportunities within the school system for kids to restart those fires inside and get excited about something they're doing. Let me take a simple example. Most schools kill questioning. When a kid is 4 or 5 years old, they ask 1,000 questions every day. But the moment evaluation comes into their educational system in a traditional school, questions start dying they die within 3 to 6 months, 6, 7 years old. The average high school student in the U.S. asks about one question per month of substance in a class. They're brain dead when it comes to asking questions that matter. And so if there's one thing I could wave a magic wand and get the teachers of this country and world to do differently, it would be to step back and hear and provoke questions from the people in their classes, the ones that matter to them, so we can figure out what are they interested in and chase that.
And you've said that places like Montessori School, which are not so reliant on standardized tests, very often cultivate that kind of asking question or working on a project.
There's a great quick example. TBWA, the global advertising agency, is connected with Room 13, an organization started in Scotland and now around the world. Here's what they do. The kids between the ages of 6 and 13, when they finish their homework, they go to a room where they learn to do art. They have a local artist in residence. They're run as a team of 6 to 13-year-olds with a president and a secretary, and they literally operate this Room 13. They learn art. They learn how to run a business. They learn how to sell. They learn how to get the supplies. They learn how to do all that stuff at a very low cost. It gives them hope. It gives them creativity skills. It gives them some sense of how a business runs. And these are the kinds of things that are done in other places in the world that they supplement what we're doing in schools, but they give us some of this creativity that we all need.
And a final question. When you think about, you know, like we said, you've been all over the world, you've taught all over the world. When you think about the countries that are poised to be leaders in 10 years, in 15 years, when you see, you know, the landscape out there, what are some companies that you would point us to and say, keep your eye on these companies and on these countries? They're really doing something interesting, different countries around the world.
One of the countries that I recently was introduced to and absolutely intrigued by is South Africa. And it's because you've got this intersectional world where different people from different backgrounds and different histories are bumping into each other. And I'm not sure if they're going to be able to pull it off in 10 or 15 years, but if they can figure out how to continue to make those bumps at the intersection work so people with different viewpoints are seeing and talking about it, they will create some very fascinating things for the future. You may have seen the Broadway and West End show War Horse. The puppets were made by a company based out of Cape Town, South Africa. And there's just a rich range of really interesting creative people in that country. And it's not just South Africa. It's any country that opens up its borders and its minds enough that you get diversity of perspective coming into conversations And the ability to take those new ideas that come up and take them forward, those are the countries that will win.
We've been talking about rethinking what it means to run a successful company and a successful country. I've been speaking with Hal Gregersen, a professor at INSEAD, co-author of The Innovator's Dilemma, and an author of Forbes' Most Innovative Companies. Hal Gregersen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kara.
Well, it may look like fall outside and feel like it, but WGBH's Jared Bowen is going to defy Mother Nature and bring us a wintertime tradition by way of the Boston Pops. But first, we're checking in with the GBH newsroom for an update on the Tim Cahill trial. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.
Good afternoon from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston. I'm Christina Quinn with a breaking news update. A verdict has been reached in the corruption trial of former state treasurer Tim Cahill. Cahill's former aide Scott Campbell has been found not guilty of corruption charges, but jurors are deadlocked on charges against Cahill himself. WGBH's Adam Riley, who is at the courthouse, is reporting that the judge has asked them to keep deliberating. Cahill and Scott Campbell were charged with violating state ethics laws by scheming to use $1.5 million in state lottery advertisements to boost Cahill's 2010 independent campaign for governor. Jurors have been deliberating since last week in the case. Today they found Campbell not guilty of the charges against him, but said they couldn't reach a consensus on the charges against Cahill. Campbell smiled broadly after the verdict was read, and Cahill patted him on the back. I'm Christina Quinn. For more news, visit WGBHnews.org. And now back to Boston Public Radio.